Case number 13-7093, Michael H. Holland et al. Versus Bebo Construction Company, a corporation, appellant, Valley Services, Inc., a corporation. Ms. Woodrum for the appellant, Ms. Burns for the appellees.
Good morning.
Good morning, Madam. I'm John Woodrum. I represent the appellant, Bebo Construction, in this matter. I've reserved 2 minutes for rebuttal. This appeal presents two separate issues. The first is whether Section 9721 of the Co-Industry Retiree Health Benefit Act permits Bebo Construction to invoke a latches defense where the benefit plan in this case did not notify Bebo until 2004 that it was required to pay premiums on behalf of an individual that the plan enrolled in 1995. The second issue is whether Section 1132G2 of ERISA entitles the plan to collect interest prior to December 2004, when the plan first notified Bebo that it had an obligation to make premiums to the plan. The latches issue requires the court to construe Section 9721 of the COLE Act.
Well, or it also requires us to read Petrella. And how do you get around Petrella, the Supreme Court's case?
Petrella involved the Copyright Act, which is highly specialized, very reticulated, has a lot of provisions that put the parties on notice that an error can.
Is there anything in Petrella that said it was just confined to the Copyright Act?
Nothing said it was, but our position is that the COLE Act, because of its provision that claims arising under the COLE Act are handled in the same way as claims arising under the Multi-Employer Pension Plan Amendments Act, does create, through that act, a situation where a defendant may, in certain circumstances, raise the question of timeliness of assessment. So it distinguishes and operates independently of the Copyright Act. So one can find that in claims arising under the COLE Act, there is an opportunity for a defendant to inject the defense.
But even in the language of the statute here, there's nothing like there is in Bay Area Laundry, where you had at least the phrase in statute, as soon as practicable, which suggests a notice requirement. And obviously, once you have a notice requirement, then latches issues arise. But there's nothing in the language of this statute to suggest that, is there?
Well, 2 points to that, Judge Griffith. The first is that this court in Sandoz and subsequently the Supreme Court in Ferber were both required to interpret the statute of limitations, Section 1451. And in order to interpret that in the MEPA context, they necessarily had to look at Section 1399 because when the cause of action arises implicates 1399. You can't decide that issue without looking at 1399, which simply is the blueprint for how a plan in a very complicated statute, the Pension Plan Withdrawal Liability Act, instructs the pension plan how to go about calculating, assessing, and notifying and collecting from an employer withdrawal liability. Much more complicated, much more detailed than the COLE Act, which simply the plan simply calculates a premium and serves it on the employer. So necessarily in 1451, as applied to a MEPA case, it was necessary to interpret 1399. But that doesn't mean that there's not an as soon as practicable requirement on this plan to also issue notices promptly, because ERISA itself in 1401 imposes fiduciary duties on the trustees of this plan, and one of those duties is...
Let's imagine we agreed with you. What's the prejudice here? How were you harmed? I mean, the best that you could come up with is to go back and find a witness who would perhaps dispute the other account. But what they have is a medical examiner saying that this was caused by the dozer accident.
Well,
that's going to be hard to overcome, right? I mean, you're going to have a pretty special witness who's going to counteract that?
Well, our problem is that because of their inordinate delay, we can find no witnesses now for two reasons. One, the records, the company's, Bebo Construction's records, were destroyed in a flood shortly before the plan finally got round to informing Bebo that there was a person in this plan that could be attributed to it. And secondly, the inordinate passage of time has made it virtually impossible at this point in time to produce witnesses that would talk about the injury to Mr. Markham and whether that could be an injury that is job related.
We have the medical examiner's report, right?
All we have, all the plan produced, was a single piece of paper in which a nurse, I believe it was a nurse practitioner, not a doctor, for the plan, apparently looked at the Social Security Disability Award, which we were never provided. I don't believe the plan has it. But a nurse looked at that award and said, I conclude that the injury that this gentleman incurred in 1979, even though he worked for, I think, at least three different employers over an almost 10-year period, because he didn't get his Social Security Disability Award until 1988. So the nurse practitioner says, I have concluded that that injury that he incurred while employed by Bebo's affiliate, now defunct affiliate, was the proximate cause of his disability. And there are many cases on the books involving plan decisions about whether a disability or an accident at a mine site is responsible for a miner's subsequent disability, because this was a young man, he was in his 20s, and so whether or not his ultimate disability was a result of that mine accident is very questionable.
But I go back. Go ahead.
Wouldn't we review that on, I mean, aren't we supposed to review those types of determinations by the plan under a pretty deferential standard?
The issue was never actually litigated, Judge Wilkins, in the first place, but there are a lot of facts that both parties put into the record about the disability. And those pension plan awards, I presume, would be reviewed under a deferential standard. But we've never had the opportunity to even question that, see the records, produce any kind of witnesses or attempt to find any, and probably, in honesty, couldn't find them now because the injury occurred in 1979.
Counsel, I'd like to go back to the statute and ask you, you suggest we should distinguish Petrella as confined to the Copyright Act. I want to be clear why this court shouldn't take Congress at its word in that it did not include any what I'll call leeway language, but simply enacted a statute with a very definite goal in mind and basically said, if you buy a company or own a company, caveat emptor, you better be aware of any potential liability, because we want to be certain that these injured miners, are cared for. And that's a policy decision by Congress. And after Petrella, I need to understand why you think we can work our way around that, given that you could argue that the Coal Act is, as complicated and specific a statute as the Copyright Act.
The reason the Coal Act, Judge Rogers, would permit a laches defense to be raised is because it says that claims under the Coal Act are to be handled in the same way as claims under MEPA. Therefore, in MEPA, in order to have liability for the statute to even begin to run, as this court in Sandoz and the Supreme Court noted, the plan has to have a cause of action. So both courts in that case, when confronted with objections by employers that, well, wait, if the statute doesn't begin to run until we receive the notice from the plan, we can be prejudiced because the plan could take a decade, could take infinite time to actually serve the notice.
But isn't it Section 1451 that says that there's liability for lack of contributions? And so the way I thought that this act worked was that, you know, the injured former minor gets benefits, the plan is notified, they start making contributions, and the fact that the related entity has not made contributions, that's the cause of action. Am I wrong about that?
It is correct that the cause of action arose in this case when the plan enrolled Mr. Markham and didn't receive a premium for the month of April 1995. The problem is that we can't even impute notice to Bebo about that event because it's not factually possible that it could have known that Social Security gave him.
Judge Rogers was suggesting, that's the congressional scheme they came up with. They wanted to help coal miners in the process.
Kind of liability has been imposed on many non-employers through their relationship to an employer. But the issue here is almost unique in the sense that a person, you know, if a person's going to get a pension, an age and service pension, you are on notice of that. Here, you can't know whether someone is going to receive a disability pension. Only the plan knows that. And the plan took 10 years to notify us that they had enrolled someone.
Congress took into account, arguably, that there might be delays in notification, did it not, when it included the 6-year statute of limitations?
It did, except that it also said that these obligations are to be treated the same as withdrawal payment obligations. And to finish my answer to your prior question, Judge Rogers, the courts in Sandoz and Ferber both stated that in response to the employer's concerns that could create a large swath of time before a cause of action arose and they wouldn't be able to have access to the evidence to defend, that in that case, the employers have a right to raise the timeliness issue. It's raised there in arbitration because that statute is an arbitration first statute. We don't have arbitration under the COA Act. So to address the same concern for a MEPA notice and assessment of payment, the district court would be empowered to consider whether the extreme delay that was raised in those Sandoz and Ferber cases, whether that extreme delay did trigger an opportunity to raise the defense of latches, which makes it different from Petrella. I see my time is run. I'd like to make one comment on the...
Let me ask you, did Judge Wilkins have a question?
I did have a question, and that is, could some of the, I guess, perceived inequity of this been mitigated if you had settled before a complaint was filed or submitted an offer of judgment? You could have avoided some of the liquidated damages, perhaps attorney's fees, not sure about the interest, but you could have mitigated some of your liability, right?
The problem with that, Judge Wilkins, is that the plan sued us retroactive for premiums retroactive to 1993.
Well, that was there when they first contacted you, but that was way before any complaint was filed.
No, Your Honor. That was part of the complaint. We had to litigate that issue in district court, and we ultimately prevailed on the exclusion of the premiums for periods prior to the 6 years, which at the time they sent us the letter was the overwhelming bulk of the claim. We've been in litigation because they've taken a very forceful position, and they've actually lost on the statute of limitations.
Yeah, I understand that, but what I'm saying is that the first communication you got from the plan wasn't a lawsuit, right?
Correct.
And your response to that could have been, okay, your legal position is wrong in trying to go back too far. We'll give, you know, here's an offer of judgment for what you're entitled to beginning in whatever it was, 2000. And you could have avoided some of the liability if you had done that, right?
If you rule against us on statute of limitations, then with the benefit of hindsight, that would have been true. But it's Bebo's position that it is not liable and that it is entitled to the defense of latches and therefore owes nothing. So we would have been forced to make an offer in a situation where we believe the undue and unjustifiable delay of the plan creates no liability for the company.
Doesn't the fact that the plan trustees have a fiduciary duty cut against you in the sense that what happened here shouldn't happen very often because plan trustees wait, you know, 10 years or more at their peril because they're making contributions during all that time and not getting the reimbursement, so to speak, from the employer or the related entity, and they could face liability for their negligence in that sense.
That's correct, and that point was noted in both Sandoz and in the Ferber decisions as an impetus for the plan to act. I think that's correct, that is true. The plan did have an obligation to act much faster than it did. Our problem is that because it took so long to act, we're effectively without an ability to challenge whether this gentleman should ever have been enrolled in the plan in the first instance, because true, he has an SSA disability award, but we think it highly questionable that is a result of an accident that occurred while he was employed in 1979 by an affiliate of Bebo. And so we simply never had any kind of notice, nor could we have learned ourselves that this gentleman was even in the plan until we got that notice, which therefore is analogous to a notice and demand for payment, analogous to the same notice and demand of payment for withdrawal liability under MEPA, for which this court and the Supreme Court have said the employer does have an opportunity to raise the challenge of whether or not the plan acted as soon as practical in making that assessment against the employer.
Why don't we hear from opposing counsel?
If I could indulge the court, just one point on the interest.
I'll give you a couple of minutes in rebuttal.
I can do that on rebuttal. Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Kathleen Burns, and I represent the UMWA 1992 Benefit Plan. At council table with me is David Allen and Larry Newsom. In this case, the 1992 plan did not know about the existence of Bebo Construction until 2004. At the time we found out about the likelihood that they may be a related person under the Cole Act, the 1992 plan sent a letter to Bebo Construction advising them of the fact that we thought that they were a potentially related person, and if they had any information that would contradict this point, that they should please provide that to us.
But how could it be that since Bebo Construction used the same phone number as the Bebo mining entity, how could it be that it took you 10 years to figure that out when all you had to do was pick up the phone and call the phone number?
The plan had the 1978 appendix sheet, which indicated a phone number for Valley Services. The plan knew that Valley Services was out of business, as Valley Services had notified us that they were out of business in 1980. Therefore, in 1995, when the beneficiary was enrolled, There was no reason for the plan to even believe or have any idea that that phone number would still be in service, much less if someone called it, that they would answer the phone and identify themselves and self-identify themselves as a related person. They didn't admit to being a related person in this matter until April or the spring of 2007, after we were forced to file a lawsuit.
Is there any sort of checklist? Go out of business, but maybe there's some sort of information left.
Yes, Your Honor. In 1980, the 74 pension plan sent a letter to Valley Services at their last known address, which asked them to give us information regarding whether or not they remained in business. They did so, and they indicated that they were out of business. There was no place on that form where they indicated a forwarding address or another company to which we could send additional correspondence regarding anything that should arise underneath the 74 pension plan or the 1950 pension plan, which existed at that time. Valley Services was signatory to a 1978 wage agreement, and they did agree to provide lifetime health benefits to disabled coal miners. Bibo Construction would have been on notice of that fact, as the principal of both companies was the same and would have known to what they signed and agreed to.
What evidence is in the record about how the plan learned about Bibo Construction?
In the record, I would direct your attention to JA-147. That would have been the second time that the plan looked into whether or not, actually the first time they looked into whether or not a related person existed. At the time a beneficiary is enrolled in the plan, the plan staff would look at the available records they had within the plan. That would have consisted of the out-of-business record, as well as any other information, the coal wage appendix agreement. Since there were no identifying related persons on those records, we then would undertake a research of public records, records that are available via the internet at that time. And public record search would cross-reference the name of the president of the company, as well as whether or not the coal company was operating at other coal mines at that time.
I mean, you can do those on, you know, Westlaw, LexisNexis, you know, state, kind of Secretary of State, you know, corporations, websites. I mean,
maybe not back in 1980.
Maybe not back in 1980, but certainly by 2000.
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct. And in 2001, the Mine Safety and Health Administration website was up and running. However, more and more records would become available every year. So at that point in time, the actual record which we used to identify Bibo Construction as being a potentially related person wasn't online. It became online subsequently at some point in 2004, or at least that's when it first came to our attention, when we re-reviewed the matter to determine whether or not a related person existed. It is unique that with every year and passage of time, more and more information actually becomes available online rather than less information.
As a matter of law, do you think the plan was obligated to send to Bibo the type of letter it did here, or could it just brought a lawsuit instead?
I do not believe that the 92 plan is required to send a letter. The statute indicates that the design and the administration of the plan is up to the 1992 plan, and
they could have just filed a lawsuit at the time.
That is correct.
What about the perceived and actual inequity of a party not knowing? I mean, you can say that, well, Mr. Bibo knew that he should have known that the Coal Act had come along and that his other entity might be a related person and there might be liability, but how could he know when or if there was going to be someone who was injured who he would be responsible for? And how is he to avoid, you know, interest and liquidated damages, et cetera, and attorney's fees? Isn't this an inequitable circumstance?
No, Your Honor, it's not. When the beneficiary in this matter was injured, That was in 1979, and at that point in time, Valley Services had signed the 1978 wage agreement, which did obligate the coal operator to provide lifetime health benefits for disability pensioners. Therefore, at that time, they should have known that it was a possibility that a disabled coal miner could eventually, at some point in the future, receive a disability determination from the Social Security
Administration. This is sort of a due diligence argument. And if you're going to purchase a company, you better do due diligence, find out what potential liabilities are. I'm just trying to understand.
Well, no, it's actually not.
Response to Judge Wilkins' question.
It's actually not a due diligence argument. The owner of the company, the related person provision provides that the same owners of the company had to have been the owners of the original coal company. In this case, that owner at all times was on notice, therefore he should have known about the disabled.
On notice of what? That's what I want to understand.
That this Valley Services was obligated and agreed to pay lifetime health benefits to a retired coal miner. The Coal Act merely is a continuation.
So why isn't that due diligence? I want to buy a company, and I have to find out what obligations that company has. I'm just trying to understand.
Correct. Related persons.
So here, somebody in the corporation bought into Valley Services.
No, Your Honor.
No.
Valley Services was owned by one individual in 1979 when they went out of business. At the same time, that same individual owned 100% of another company. Therefore, that made them a related person under the Coal Act. So there was the buying of a company actually would cut off the related person nature of the Coal Act.
So
it would
Valley
extinguish
Services
it.
Was owned by?
It was owned by Mr. Bebo.
Mr. Bebo, who is the same Mr. Bebo in this construction company?
Yes, Your Honor.
And the fact that the construction company was operating simultaneously with the, I guess, cessation of operations of Valley Services is what makes the construction company the related entity.
Yes, Your Honor.
How important are the equities to your argument here? I mean, I noticed you, when you stood up, the very first thing you talked about was sort of an equitable argument, what was fair here, that they were on notice, there was no surprise here. Is that critical to your argument, though?
No, Your Honor. It's our position that latches is simply an unavailable defense to Bebo Construction. We would rely on the Petrella case, as well as many other Supreme Court cases that found that when there is a statute of limitations in the statute.
You're saying Congress, if they want to, they can be unfair, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
No comment.
Let the record reflect that Judge Griffith asked that question. But why is it that the fact that, as your opposing counsel states, that this statute is to be construed the same as the MPPA, why isn't he right that somehow takes this out of the dictates of Petrella?
Because the Coal Act did not bring bring all of the statutes from ERISA into it. It incorporated by reference the fact that there is a statute of limitations as well as the enforcement mechanism. It did not bring into the statute the as soon as practicable language. In fact, the fact that there is a related person portion of this would seem to indicate that Congress envisioned the fact that it may take a longer period of time to find related persons. We did not know about Bebo Construction until 2004, and the 92 plan's remedy has been limited by the statute of limitations in this matter.
Is there anything unique about or different about withdrawal liability where it's not really analogous to this sort of liability?
Yes, Your Honor. Withdrawal liability, the pension plan knows which company has withdrawn. They know where to locate them and how to identify them. In this matter, we knew of Valley Services. We did not know about the related company. That is the major difference.
Anything further?
No, Your Honor.
Thank you. Counsel for appellant?
Several points. First of all, I want to make very clear that Valley Services, the signatory to the contract that generated this ultimate COAC liability, did not have a lifetime obligation to provide health care benefits to its retirees. It had an obligation to provide those benefits during the term of its agreement. That issue had been decided by the Fourth Circuit in the Royal Coal case, which we cited in our brief. It is because the coal companies did not have a lifetime obligation that the COAC was enacted in the first place and reached back and imposed that obligation on them. So
What do you make of your opponent's point that Mr. Bebo shouldn't have been surprised by this, right? I mean, he was in the coal industry.
Mr. Bebo is still surprised by this today because...
I said he shouldn't have been, not what he actually was. He shouldn't have been. He's in the industry. He knew what was going on.
He owned the company.
Yeah.
Well, he owned the company, but the company, when he went out... He signed an agreement, but that agreement said that he only had to provide benefits to his retirees for the life of that agreement. And that agreement...
He received the letter he denied he knew anything about.
I'm sorry.
According to the record.
No. He did not waffle on any obligation that he had. When he closed the construction company, and this is in the affidavit and the record, he met with his employees, he paid everything he owed them, and he left. He walked away and went back to New York.
But shouldn't he be on notice that, you know, that there was such a thing as the Coal Act?
Well, as Judge Griffin pointed out, I guess he should be, as we all should be, on notice that Congress can do really extreme things. He had his company, Valley Services.
Is that what I said?
Perhaps I've imbued that with my own view. But his company had no obligation to provide health care benefits.
So your conception is that Congress imposes this lifetime obligation, and the way to get out of it is simply to close your company, pay off whatever current liabilities there are, and you are forever immune, as it were, to this obligation?
No, not at all.
And what is your argument?
My point is that at the time Valley Services closed, there was no contractual or statutory obligation to provide benefits to any person, any retiree who had ever worked at that company, and except for the remainder of the life of the contract. Mm-hmm. But in 1993, 14 years later, Congress enacts the COAC Act after Mr. Bebo has exited the field, and it imposed this obligation by statute. Moreover, he couldn't even have known that Mr. Markham was going to be a UMW retiree. He was just in his 20s. It was only because a decade later he got a disability award that he even qualified for this benefit. So I just wanted to be clear that there could not possibly have been any run and hide or evasion of liability through anything that Mr. Bebo did. These are all very retroactive obligations that did not even exist when his Valley Services company was mining. And I wanted to comment on the interest because...
All right, I appreciate your clarifying the record. What is your argument on interest?
The interest, the district court awarded the plan because they asked for it interest that predated the date that the notice was given to Mr. Bebo that he had an obligation. And our point is that under 1132G of ERISA, which does provide the plan entitlement to interest on a delinquency when it sues and it prevails, there was no delinquency until such time as Mr. Bebo or Bebo Construction was given the notice in December 2004 was the first time he even knew there was an obligation that he was required to pay. And it couldn't have even been imputed with that knowledge by everybody knows the law or is presumed to know the law, because even if he had read the Coal Act and knew every provision in it, he couldn't have known that Mr. Markham was in there as a factual matter. So he could not have failed and refused to pay that statutory obligation until after December 2004. So it's sort of a due process, plain language kind of argument here that it's inappropriate and rewarding the plan for their delay to award them interest on premiums that had accrued prior to that time. And the plan conflates accrual with notice and liability.
Wouldn't the same argument then apply to, you know, liability for any contributions before he had notice?
That is their argument. We think we're entitled to defend that, but on the latches theory. But if you disagree with us on that, the statute does say that he had an obligation to make the premium payments. So he is obligated in that situation to make premium payments that fell within the 6-year statute of limitations, as the lower court found. We continue to maintain that if we would prevail on latches, he would not have that obligation. So the interest and the premiums are two different issues to be considered.
All right. Anything further?
On the related person, just to point out that Mr. Bebo owned Valley Services with his wife, so he owned 50%, and they were subsequently divorced. He always owned 100% of Bebo Construction. Once the case got on, it was learned that under the attribution rules that he has attributed his wife's interest. So once the litigation got going, we did acknowledge that Bebo Construction was a related person. But it's not a situation where he simply refused to admit a fact once he got that letter that he was aware of, because he thought they weren't related by virtue of those events.
Thank you. We'll take the case under advisement.